It is a stupid blunder to look back at the little we know of the past, and say that it is the unerring index finger telling us what is to be in the future. If this planet has been what geology teaches it has been, a planet fuller of coarser, cruder, and more violent forces than now, abounding in forms of coarser vegetable, animal, and even human life and organization than now, of which its present condition is a refinement and improvement as regards vegetable, animal, and man, is not this the suggestion, the hint, the proof, of a still greater refinement and improvement for the future, a refinement and improvement going on now? Does not refinement imply greater power, as the greater power of the crude iron comes out in steel, and are not these greater and as yet almost unrecognized powers to come out of the highest and most complex form of known organization, man, and are all of man's powers yet known? Internally, secretly, among the thinking thousands of this and other lands, is this and many other questions now being asked? Why must we so wither and decay, and lose the best that life is worth living for, just as we have gained that experience and wisdom that best fits us to live? The voice of the people is always at first a whispered voice. The prayer or demand or desire of the masses is always at first a secret prayer, demand, wish, or desire, which one man at first dares scarcely whisper to his neighbor for fear of ridicule. But it is a law of nature, that every demand, silent or spoken, brings its supply of the thing wished for in proportion to the intensity of the wish, and the growing numbers so wishing, who, by the action of their minds upon some one subject, set in motion that silent force of thought, not as yet heeded in the world's schools of philosophy, which brings the needed supply. Millions so wished in silence for means to travel more rapidly, to send intelligence more rapidly, and this brought steam and the electric telegraph. Soon other questions and demands are to be answered, questions ever going out in silence from multitudes, and, in answering them, in at first attempting to carry out and prove the answers and the means shown to accomplish or realize many things deemed impossible or visionary, there will be mistake and stupidity, and blunder and silliness, and breakdowns and failures, and consequent ridicule, just as there were 10 smashes on railways, and 10 bursted boilers in the earlier era of the use of steam, to one of today. But a truth always goes straight ahead despite mistake and blunder, and proves itself at last. There are two kinds of age, the age of your body, and the age of your mind. Your body in a sense is but a growth, a construction, of today, and for the use of today. Your mind is another growth or construction millions of years old. It has used many bodies in its growth. It has grown from very small beginnings to its present condition, power, and capacity in the use of these many bodies. You have, in using these bodies, been far ruder and coarser than you are now. You have lived as now you could not live at all, and in forms of life or expression very different from the form you are now using, and each new body or young body you have worn has been a new suit of clothes for your mind, and what you call death has been and is but the wearing out of this suit through ignorance of the means, not so much of keeping it in repair, as of building it continually into a newer and newer freshness and vitality. You are not young relatively. Your present youth means that your body is young. The older your spirit, the better can you preserve the youth, vigor, and elasticity of your body. Because the older your mind, the more power has it gathered from its many existences. You can use that power for the preservation of beauty, of health, of vigor, of all that can make you attractive to others. You can also unconsciously use the same power to make you ugly, unhealthy, weak, diseased, and unattractive. The more you use this power in either of these directions, the more will it make you ugly or beautiful, healthy or unhealthy, attractive or unattractive, that is, as regards unattractiveness for this one existence. Ultimately you must, if not in this in some other existence, be symmetrical, because the evolution of the mind, of which the evolution of our bodies from coarser to higher forms is but a crude counterpart, is ever toward the higher, finer, better, and happier. That power is your thought. Every thought of yours is a thing as real, though you cannot see it with the physical, or outer eye, as a tree, a flower, a fruit. Your thoughts are continually molding your muscles into shapes and manner of movement in accordance with their character. If your thought is always determined and decided, your step in walking will be decided. If your thought is permanently decided, your whole carriage, bearing, and address will show that if you say a thing, you mean it. If your thoughts are permanently undecided, you will have a permanently undecided gesture, address, carriage, or manner of using your body, and this, when long continued, will make the body grow decidedly misshapen in some way, exactly as when you are writing in a mood of hurry, your hurried thought makes misshapen letters, and sometimes misshapen ideas, while your reposeful mood or thought makes well-formed letters and graceful curves as well as well-formed and graceful ideas. You are every day thinking yourself into some phase of character and facial expression, good or bad. If your thoughts are permanently cheerful, your face will look cheerful. If most of the time you are in a complaining, peevish, quarrelsome mood, this kind of thought will put ugly lines on your face. They will poison your blood, make you dyspeptic, and ruin your complexion, because then you are in your own unseen laboratory of mind, generating an unseen and poisonous element, your thought, and as you put it out or think it, by the inevitable law of nature it attracts to it the same kind of thought element from others. You think or open your mind to the mood of despondency or irritability, and you draw more or less of the same thought element from every despondent or irritable man or woman in your town or city. You are then charging your magnet, your mind, with its electric thought current of destructive tendency, and the law and property of thought connects all the other thought currents of despondency or irritability with your mental battery, your mind. If we think murder or theft, we bring ourselves by this law into spiritual relationship and rapport with every thief or murderer in the world. Your mind can make your body sick or well, strong or weak, according to the thought it puts out, and the action upon it of the thought of others. Cry fire. In a crowded theater, and scores of persons are made tremulous, weak, paralyzed by fear. Perhaps it was a false alarm. It was only the thought of fire, a horror acting on your body, that took away its strength. The thought or mood of fear has in cases so acted on the body as to turn the hair white in a few hours. Angered, peevish, worried, or irritable thought affects injuriously the digestion. A sudden mental shock may lose one's whole appetite for a meal, or cause the stomach to reject such meal when eaten. The injury so done the body suddenly, in a relatively few cases, by fear or other evil state of mind, works injury more gradually on millions of bodies all over the planet. Dyspepsia does not come so much of the food we eat, as of the thoughts we think while eating it. We may eat the healthiest bread in the world, and if we eat it in a sour temper, we will put sourness in our blood, and sourness in our stomachs, and sourness on our faces. Or if we eat in an anxious frame of mind, and are worrying all the time about how much we should eat or should not eat, and whether it may not hurt us after all, we are consuming anxious, worried, fretful thought element with our food and it will poison us. If we are cheerful and chatty and lively and jolly while eating, we are putting liveliness and cheer into ourselves, and making such qualities more and more a part of ourselves. And if our family group eat in silence, or come to the table with a sort of forced and resigned air, as if saying, each one to him or herself, well, all this must be gone over again, and the head of the family buries himself in his business cares, or his newspaper, and reads all their murders and suicides and burglaries and scandals for the last 24 hours, and the queen of the household buries herself in sullen resignation or household cares, then there are being literally consumed at that table, along with the food, the thought element of worry and murder and suicide and the morbid element, which loves to dwell on the horrible and ghastly, and, as a result, dyspepsia, in some of its many forms, will be manufactured all the way down the line, from one end of the table to the other. If the habitual expression of a face be a scowl, it is because the thoughts behind that face are mostly scowls. If the corners of a mouth are turned down, It is because most of the time the thoughts which govern and shape that mouth are gloomy and despondent. If a face does not invite people, and make them desire to get acquainted with its wearer, it is because that face is a sign advertising thoughts behind it which the wearer may not dare to speak to others, possibly may not dare to whisper to himself. The continual mood of hurry, that is, of being in mind or spirit in a certain place long before the body is there, will cause the shoulders to stoop forward, because in such mood you do literally send your thought, your spirit, your real though invisible self, to the place toward which your power, your thought, is dragging your body head first, and through such lifelong habit of mind does the body grow as the thought shapes it. A self-contained man is never in a hurry, and a self-contained man keeps or contains his thought, his spirit, his power, mostly on the act or use he is making at the present moment with the instrument his spirit uses. His body, and the habitually self-possessed woman will be graceful in every movement, for the reason that her spirit has complete possession and command of its tool, the body, and is not a mile or 10 miles away from that body in thought, and fretting or hurrying or dwelling on something at that distance from her body. When we form a plan for any business, any invention, any undertaking, we are making something of that unseen element, our thought, as real, though unseen, as any machine of iron or wood. That plan or thought begins, as soon as made, to draw to itself, in more unseen elements, power to carry itself out, power to materialize itself in physical or visible substance. When we dread a misfortune, or live in fear of any ill, or expect ill luck, we make also a construction of unseen element, thought, which, by the same law of attraction, draws to it destructive, and to you damaging, forces or elements. Thus the law for success is also the law for misfortune, according as it is used, even as the force of a man's arm can save another from drowning, or strike a dagger to his heart. Of whatever possible thing we think, we are building, in unseen substance, a construction which will draw to us forces or elements to aid us or hurt us, according to the character of thought we think or put out. If you expect to grow old, and keep ever in your mind an image or construction of yourself as old and decrepit, you will assuredly be so. You are then making yourself so. If you make a plan in thought, in unseen element, for yourself, as helpless, and decrepit, such plan will draw to you of unseen thought element that which will make you weak, helpless, and decrepit. If, on the contrary, you make for yourself a plan for being always healthy, active, and vigorous, and stick to that plan, and refuse to grow decrepit, and refuse to believe the legions of people who will tell you that you must grow old, you will not grow old. It is because you think it must be so, as people tell you, that makes it so. If you in your mind are ever building an ideal of yourself as strong, healthy, and vigorous, you are building to yourself of invisible element that which is ever drawing to you more of health, strength, and vigor. You can make of your mind a magnet to attract health or weakness. If you love to think of the strong things in nature, of granite mountains and heaving billows and resistless tempests, you attract to you their elements of strength. If you build yourself in health and strength today, and despond and give up such thinking or building tomorrow, you do not destroy what in spirit and of spirit you have built up. That amount of element so added to your spirit can never be lost, but you do, for the time, in so desponding, that is, thinking weakness, stop the building of your health structure, and although your spirit is so much the stronger for that addition of element, it may not be strong enough to give quickly to the body what you may have taken from it through such despondent thought. Persistency in thinking health, in imagining or idealizing yourself as healthy, vigorous, and symmetrical, is the cornerstone of health and beauty. Of that which you think most, that you will be, and that you will have most of, you say no. But your bedridden patient is not thinking, I am strong, he or she is thinking, I am so weak. Your dyspeptic man or woman is not thinking, I will have a strong stomach. They are ever saying, I can't digest anything. And they can't, for that very reason. We are a partment to nurse our maladies rather than nurse ourselves. We want our maladies petted and sympathized with, more than ourselves. When we have a bad cold, our very cough sometimes says to others, unconsciously, I am this morning an object for your sympathy. I am so afflicted. It is the cold, then, that is calling out for sympathy. Were the body treated rightly, your own mind and all the minds about you would say to that weak element in you, get out of that body. And the silent force of a few minds so directed would drive that weakness out. It would leave as Satan did when the man of Nazareth imperiously ordered him. Colds and all other forms of disease are only forms of Satan, and thrive also by nursing. Vigor and health are catching also as well as the measles. What would many grown-up people give for a limb or two limbs that had in them the spring and elasticity of those owned by a boy 12 years old, for two limbs that could climb trees, walk on rail fences, and run because they loved to run, and couldn't help running? If such limbs, so full of life, could be manufactured and sold, would there not be a demand for them by those stout ladies and gentlemen who get in and out of their carriages as if their bodies weighed a ton? Why is it that humanity resigns itself with scarcely a protest to the growing heaviness, sluggishness, and stiffness that comes even with middle age? I believe, however, we compromise with this inertia, and call it dignity. Of course a man and a father and a citizen and a voter and a pillar of the state of inertia shouldn't run and cut up and kick up like a boy, because he can't. Neither should a lady who has grown to the dignity of a waddle run as she did when a girl of 12, because she can't, either. Actually, we put on our infirmities as we would masks, and hobble around in them, saying, this is the thing to do, because we can't do anything else. Sometimes we are even in a hurry to put them on, like the young gentleman who sticks an eyeglass to his eye, and thereby the sooner ruins the sight of a sound organ, in order to look tony or bookish. There are more and more possibilities in nature, in the elements, and in man and out of man, and they come as fast as man sees and knows how to use these forces in nature and in himself. Possibilities and miracles mean the same thing. The telephone sprung suddenly on our folks of 200 years ago would have been a miracle, and might have consigned the person using it to the prison or the stake, all unusual manifestations of nature's powers being then attributed to the devil, because the people of that period had so much of the devil, or cruder element, in them as to insist that the universe should not continually show and prove higher and higher expressions of the higher mind for man's comfort and pleasure. Chapter 8. Museum and Menagerie Horrors. A menagerie of beasts and birds means a collection of captured walking and flying creatures, taken from their natural modes of life, deprived permanently of such modes, and suffering more or less in consequence. The bird, used to the freedom of forest and air, is imprisoned in the most limited quarters. Its plumage there is never as fresh and glossy as in its natural state. It does not live as long. The captive life of the many species brought from the tropics is very short, especially of the smaller and more delicate species. Bears, lions, tigers, deer, wolves and all other animals like liberty and freedom of range as well as man. In the menagerie they are deprived of it. The air they breathe is often fetid and impure. To the burrowing animal, earth is as much a necessity and comfort as a comfortable bed is to us. The captured burrower is often kept on a hard board floor, which, in its restless misery to get into its native earth, it scratches and wears away in cavities inches in depth. Monkeys by the thousand die prematurely of consumption, because forced to live in a climate too cold and damp for them, and no amount of artificial heat can supply the element to which they have been accustomed in the air of their native tropic groves and jungles. Seals are kept in tanks of fresh water, when salt water is their natural element. Their captive lives are always short. There is no form of organized life but is a part and belonging of the locality and latitude where in its wild state it is born. The polar bear is a natural belonging of the Arctic regions. The monkey is a belonging and outgrowth of tropical conditions. When either of these is taken from climes native to them, and out of which they do not voluntarily wander, pain is inflicted on them. Go to the cheap museum, now so plentiful, and regard the bedraggled plumage and apparent sickly condition of many of the birds, natives of distant climes, imprisoned there. You see them but for an hour. Return in a few months and you will not find them. What has become of them? They have died, and their places are supplied by others likewise slowly dying. The procession of captives so to suffer and die prematurely never ceases moving into these places. Ships are constantly bringing them hither. An army of men distributed all over the world, and ranging through the forests of every clime, is constantly engaged in trapping them. For what reasons are all these concentrations of captured misery, now to be found in every large town and city of our country? Simply to gratify human curiosity. Simply that we may stand a few minutes and gaze at them behind their bars. What do we then learn of their real natures and habits in these prisons? What would be learned of your ill tastes, inclinations and habits were you kept constantly in a cage? Is the gratification of this curiosity worth the misery it costs? If a bird wooed by your kindness comes and builds its nest in a tree near your window, and there rears its brood, is not the sight it affords from day to day worth 100 times more than that of the same bird, deprived of its mate and shut up in a cage? Will you not? Is in its freedom you study its real habits and see its real and natural life, feel more and more drawn to it by the tie of a common sympathy, as you see evidenced in that life so much that belongs to your own? Like you, it builds a home, like you, it has affection and care for its mate, like you, it provides for its family, like you, it is alarmed at the approach of danger, like you, it nestles in the thought of security. Yet so crude and cruel still is the instinct in our race, that the ruin of the wild bird's home, or its slaughter or capture, is the ruling desire with 19 boys out of 20 as they roam the woods, and cultured parents will see their children leave the house equipped with the means for this destruction without even the thought of protest. Chapter 9. The God in Yourself. As a spirit, you are a part of God or the infinite force or spirit of good. As such part, you are an ever-growing power which can never lessen, and must always increase, even as it has in the past through many ages always increased, and built you up, as to intelligence, to your present mental stature. The power of your mind has been growing to its present quality and clearness through many more physical lives than the one you are now living. Through each past life you have unconsciously added to its power. Every struggle of the mind, be it struggle against pain, struggle against appetite, struggle for more skill in the doing of anything, struggle for greater advance in any art or calling, struggle and dissatisfaction at your failings and defects is an actual pushing of the spirit to greater power, and a great relative completion of yourself, and with such completion, happiness. For the aim of living is happiness. There is today more of you, and more of every desirable mental quality belonging to you, than ever before. The very dissatisfaction and discontent you may feel concerning your failings is a proof of this. If your mind was not as clear as it is, it could not see those failings. You are not now where you may have been in a mood of self-complacency, when you thought yourself about right in every respect. Only you may, now, in looking at yourself, have swung too far in the opposite direction, and, because your eyes have been suddenly opened to certain faults, you may think these faults to be constantly increasing. They are not. The God in yourself, the ever-growing power in yourself, has made you see an incompleteness in your character, yet that incompleteness was never so near a relative completion as now. Of this the greatest proof is, that you can now see what in yourself you never saw or felt before. You may have under your house a cavity full of vermin and bad air. You were much worse off before the cavity was found, repulsive as it may be to you, and now that it is found, you may be sure it will be cleansed. There may be cavities in a mental architecture abounding in evil element, and there is no need to be discouraged as the God in ourself shows them to us. There is no need of saying, "I'm such an imperfect creature, I'm sure I can never cure all my faults." Yes, you can. You are curing them now. Every protest of your mind against your fault is a push of the spirit forward. Only you must not expect to cure them all in an hour, a day, a week, or a year. There will never be a time in your future existence, but that you can see where you can improve yourself. If you see possibility of improvement, you must of course see the defect to be improved. Or, in other words, you see for yourself a still greater completion, a still greater elaboration, a finer and finer shading of your character, a more and more complicated distribution of the force always coming to you. So you will cease this fretting over your being such an imperfect creature when you find, as you will, that you are one of the temples of God ever being built by yourself into ever-increasing splendor. No talent of yours ever stops growing any more than the tree stops growing in winter. If you are learning to paint or draw or act or speak in public or do anything, and cease your practice entirely for a month or a year or 2 years, and then take it up again, you will find after a little that an increase of that talent has come, that you have new ideas concerning it, and new power for execution. You ask, what is the aim of life? In a sense, you cannot aim your own life. There is a destiny that aims it, a law which governs and carries it. To what? To an ever-increasing and illimitable capacity for happiness as your power increases, and increase it must. You cannot stop growing, despite all appearances to the contrary. The pain you have suffered has been through that same growth of the spirit pressing you harder and harder against what caused you misery, so that at last you should take that pain as a proof that you were on some wrong path, out of which you must get as soon as possible. And when you cry out hard, and are in living earnest to know the right way, something will always come to tell you the right way, for it is a law of nature that every earnest call is answered, and an earnest demand or prayer for anything always brings the needed supply. What is the aim of life? To get the most happiness out of it, to so learn to live that every coming day will be looked for in the assurance that it will be as full, and even fuller, of pleasure than the day we now live in, to banish even the recollection that time can hang heavily on our hands, to be thankful that we live, to rise superior to sickness or pain, to command the body, through the power of the spirit, so that it can feel no pain, to control and command the thought so that it shall ever increase in power to work and act separate, apart, and afar from our body, so that it shall bring us all that we need of house or land or food or clothes, and that, without robbing or doing injustice to anyone, to gain in power so that the spirit shall ever recuperate, reinvigorate, and rejuvenate the body so long as we desire to use it, so that no part or organ shall weaken, wither, or decay, to be learning ever new sources of amusement for ourselves and others, to make ourselves so full of happiness and use for others, that our presence may ever be welcome to them, to be no one's enemy and everyone's friend, that is the destiny of life in those domains of existence where people as real as we, and much more alive than we, have learned, and are ever learning, how to get the most of heaven out of life. That is the inevitable destiny of every individual spirit. You cannot escape ultimate happiness and permanent happiness as you grow on and on in this and other existences, and all the pains you suffer, or have suffered, are as prods and pokes to keep you out of wrong paths, to make you follow the law. And the more sensitive you grow, the more clearly will you see the law which leads away from all pain, and ever toward more happiness, and to a state of mind where it is such an ecstasy to live, that all sense of time is lost, as the sense of time is lost with us when we are deeply interested or amused, or gaze upon a thrilling play or spectacle, so that in the words of the biblical record, a day shall be as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as a day. The Nirvana of the Hindus suggests all the possibilities of life coming to our planet, Nirvana implying that calmness, serenity, and confidence of mind which comes of the absolute certainty that every effort we make, every enterprise we undertake, must be successful, and that the happiness we realize this month is but the stepping stone to the greater happiness of next. If you felt that the trip of foreign travel you now long for and wish for was as certain to come as now you are certain that the sun rose this morning, if you knew that you would achieve your own peculiar and individual proficiency and triumph in painting or oratory, or as an actor or sculptor, or in any art, as surely as now you know you can walk downstairs, you would not of course feel any uneasiness,